Welcome to Stateside for this Monday. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, Boondoggles, we take a look back at some of Michigan's sorriest episodes in government spending. Then we speak with the members of the West Michigan duo Midnight Faces. They're from Grand Rapids, and they are taking a new approach to music from the 80s. But first, with school out for the summer, state officials are already looking for ways to get more kids to show up for class in the fall. The State Department of Human Services wants to expand pilot programs to put more social workers into schools with high truancy rates. At the same time, DHS has a new statewide policy that threatens to take away welfare benefits from families who have kids who persistently miss school. But critics say that still means too few families are getting the support they need to avoid losing their cash assistance. Michigan Public Radio's Jake Neer reports.
The state's idea is to provide as many support services as possible for low-income families with kids who miss school. But officials with the State Department of Human Services say if a student continues to be truant despite those efforts, there has to be some consequence. Students older than 15 already risk losing their own cash assistance if they're truant, but as of late last year, students aged 6 through 15 could be responsible for losing those benefits for their entire family.
Hello, honey.
Hi, yeah, move that cooler.
There you go.
At Floyd Elementary School in Midland, it's Erica Mealback's job to try to make sure it doesn't come to that. Mealback spends her time connecting students and their families to resources they need to avoid missing school. Today, she's working on lining up a bed for a student who doesn't have one.
And so we're working on securing a donation for that to help them out.
School officials say there are a lot fewer empty seats at Floyd Elementary these days. In just a few months, administrators say weekly absences are down by close to two-thirds of what they were when Mealback and another DHS worker came to the school. Principal Rod DeShaw says he didn't even know his school had a truancy problem a year ago.
But what we've discovered as we've looked at the data is we have kids that maybe were missing 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 days, not because of sickness, but because they had to go to grandma's and grandma lived out of town or whatever that may be.
DeShaw says the DHS workers help students find adequate transportation, appropriate school clothes, and other things. But a handful of students still slip through the cracks. As of late last month, the state had revoked welfare benefits from 54 families statewide because of school absences. DHS officials say that suggests the department is doing a good job reaching students and families before they lose their benefits. But critics of the policy say schools like Floyd Elementary are not typical cases. Pilot programs like that in Midland County only include a handful of schools. Gilda Jacobs is with the Michigan League for Public Policy. She says the vast majority of low-income families in the state are getting less carrot and more of the proverbial stick.
It's great. The wraparound services is a wonderful model to be able to provide to kids and to their families, but it's only being piloted in 4 areas. But yet, you have a situation where you've created a policy that goes for the entire state.
Jacob says it's also not fair that some children could lose their much-needed cash assistance if a sibling misses school too much.
We're just not sure that it makes sense to do something that punishes an entire family when just one child is truant.
Meanwhile, lawmakers in Lansing are considering putting the DHS policy into state law. That would mean future administrations would have to go through the legislature if they wanted to change or get rid of it. The bill passed fairly easily in the state house with bipartisan support. It's now awaiting action in the state senate. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Jake Neer in Lansing.
And speaking of students, let's turn our attention now to college students, or more specifically, college graduates. There's been much talk, much hand-wringing about the so-called brain drain, young people earning a degree at a Michigan college or university and then hitting the road, heading out of Michigan, taking their skills to places like L.A., Chicago, Boston, New York. Now, is that brain drain the fault of Michigan's depressed but slowly recovering economy? Or might it be just the age-old truth that young people want to spread their wings? Writer John Schneider mused upon these questions in a column in this week's Bridge magazine. It's entitled Children's Departure is Part of the Cycle of Life. Now, John, you were one of the dads who got a card and a long-distance phone call for Father's Day. Where did your kids head after they graduated?
Well, I have 3 children, and 2 are U of M grads, and they both initially headed to L.A., although my daughter, the youngest of my children, is now in New York City, and my My oldest boy is in Indianapolis. None of them is in Michigan. You know, I regret that sometimes, but I understand that they have to make their own way.
In a nutshell, why did they leave Michigan? Because that's what we're looking at. Is it the depressed economy, or is it, hey, I want to get away from mom and dad. I want to live my life.
You know, I don't think you can downplay too much, you know, the fact that Michigan is not the most fertile job market. But in the case of my kids, I think they just wanted to explore a little bit, and there were other reasons. I mean, my younger son initially followed a woman out to L.A. They're no longer together, but he's in the music business, so L.A. was a good place for him, and he's still there. My daughter initially went out to L.A. when she graduated because her brother was there, and she wanted to have a big city experience too. But then just about a year ago, she moved to New York City, again, following a boy, although I don't think she would acknowledge that, but that seems pretty clear.
And now you've outed her on Michigan radio, so way to go, Dad. But I guess taking your children's experiences, John Schneider, and it got you thinking about looking at that big picture and the worry about the Michigan brain drain. What is your view then on, is this a major problem for Michigan to overcome, or is this kids being kids?
Well, I think it's a little of both. I mean, I do think you need to provide better job opportunities. And you know, the other thing is the big city experience. If a kid wants, you know, grew up in a smaller town, like our kids grew up in the Lansing area, and they wanted, you know, the big city experience. I mean, there's Detroit, which is, you know, it's my hometown, and I love it. But, you know, I have to say that it's not all that appealing to young kids graduating from college. They think big city, they think Chicago, New York, L.A., you know, maybe San Francisco. But, you know, Detroit is not a city that pops into their minds when they think of the big city experience. And maybe, you know, at some point we can turn it around if Detroit ever, you know, achieves its long-promised renaissance, then, you know, that might be a place. I mean, my kids are intrigued by Detroit, and they're thinking that, you know, maybe at some point they'll land there or work there for a while. And, you know, I have nephews and nieces who are committed to Detroit. But I think for most kids, it's just not their idea of the big city they want to live in.
And the sense that, you know, Grand Rapids has kind of a buzz going about it, but you kind of feel, well, they're no Chicago.
I mean, as I wrote in my column, Lansing and Grand Rapids, you know, they try hard to give that big city experience. And Ann Arbor, to some extent, both of my kids, you know, who went to U of M loved Ann Arbor, but it's, you know, it's pretty much basically a college town, and you know, it's there are not a lot of employment opportunities outside of the university, and so I think, but you know, as you said, there is that factor of wanderlust, and you know, now is the time to do it when you're fresh out of college and you have no spouses or children to, you know, to be responsible for. That's the best time, I think, to spread your wings and see what the world has to offer.
Well, in your piece in Bridge Magazine, John Schneider, you point to a Detroit Regional Chamber study that goes back a year from 2012, and it really dug into where the graduates of Michigan's 15 public universities have gone to. And it got me wondering, is that flight of graduates not as fierce as we've been led to believe?
Well, I think it has. I think, as the study pointed out, it has tapered off a little bit, and they found that actually there are, you know, more kids staying in Lansing now than there were then.
Staying in, you know, Michigan, actually.
I'm sorry, staying in Michigan, yes. You know, in the three places they mentioned, California, Illinois, and New York. Suggest that kids, you know, want to go to a big city. I think what they're talking about there is L.A., New York City, and Chicago.
Right. But you find, 63% of the graduates are still living in Michigan. And when you think that in 2007, only 51% of that group stayed in Michigan.
That's not bad. I mean, it's going in the right direction. And you know, I'm sure that other states, you know, have the same issue. Kids, you know, the grass tends to always look greener on the other side of the fence. And I think that's certainly part of, you know, how you can explain kids leaving. I mean, kids have always left, you know, since the prodigal son.
There you go. John Schneider's piece on our departing children can be found in Bridge Magazine online at bridgemi.com. John, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And now this bit of news for you. The top marine archaeologist in France says he thinks they're close to the hull of a sunken ship in northern Lake Michigan. Michel Lior says the beam of wood now exposed is likely a bowsprit. The team excavating the site says the beam's at least 20 feet long and the construction details are typical of colonial ships. Lior says because of the way the timber rises up from the bottom of the lake, it appears to be attached to something.
We never saw timber standing up like this one. That's impossible to imagine otherwise. So one can expect that there is a hull.
This site's being excavated by Great Lakes Exploration Group, the group searching for the French ship, the Griffin, that was famously lost in 1679. Still to come, we take a good look back at some of Michigan's worst boondoggles, projects that seemed at the moment to be a good idea, only to cost millions and millions of taxpayer dollars later on. That conversation comes up in 20 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was 2007 when Dr. Amanda Lotz of the University of Michigan wrote a book. It was entitled The Television Will Be Revolutionized. The professor of communication studies predicted that eventually TV would move from the broadcast network format we all grew up with to an online subscription format. And if you're one of the fans of the series Arrested Development, you're celebrating the resurrection of that wildly popular series, which began on Fox, was canceled by Fox, but has now been revived by Netflix in, you guessed it, an online subscription format. Amanda Lotz, University of Michigan Professor of Communication Studies, joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, in your 2007 book, you wondered if video on demand viewers would be willing to buy a subscription to Arrested Development. I guess you can wonder no more.
Well, right. It's still a case where they're not having to subscribe specifically for Arrested Development. It's part of a broader package. Right. But it was the kind of show at the time that there was clearly a strong fan base that exhibited the kind of passion that would be needed to actually have people pay specifically for a show. We just didn't have the infrastructure in terms of a distribution to create that opportunity at the time.
And it's quite interesting that such an avid, rabid fan base wasn't enough to convince Fox to keep that program on the air.
Well, if you go back and look at the numbers at the time, Fox was actually surprisingly patient with the show.
Oh, okay.
It's more the difference of what the Fox business model was at the time. And so as a broadcaster, that model's built entirely on getting people to watch the show. And it is a specific show. But the thing that I was trying to point out with the kind of back-of-the-envelope tabulation that I did in the book was that it wouldn't take much even for that small audience. It was an audience of between 4 and 5 million. Mm-hmm. If even though that wasn't a big enough audience for Fox to sell to advertisers, it was a big enough audience if they would just pay a dollar or two per episode to maintain the production.
Now, Netflix broke ground in offering its original series with the Kevin Spacey vehicle House of Cards, and I will just say I am crazy about this show. And unlike Arrested Development that had a built-in pack of fans ready to jump, it was unknown stuff. And, of course, as we know, offered by Netflix in one huge chunk. Here you go, folks, all 13 episodes available at the same moment, just like they did with Arrested Development. Was Netflix the only provider, in your view, that could have done this at this point?
Let's see. HBO could release Game of Thrones, the entire season on one night or over a few nights, and then leave it up on demand or on their HBO Go
program. Okay.
Platform. And the broadcast networks, nothing that's actually technologically preventing them from releasing things this way. As House of Cards debuted, Netflix got a lot of criticism from the establishment. You know, how could you do this? Instead of you want to drive people back to you week after week or month after month, because someone could just subscribe for the month, watch House of Cards, and then drop their subscription. And Netflix was willing to bet that they had enough other value in the service that they offered that that wasn't going to happen. So technologically, there's no reason why that doesn't happen. It really just has to do with what the broadcasters are still trying to do is encourage us to watch week after week, more regularly, more often. And so giving us all the content we want at one time doesn't quite work with that model.
And what effect do you think this whole format and this idea of an online subscription format, how does this impact the writing and the content of a show?
Well, we're just Arrested Development is such an experiment with that. And in some of the interviews with Mitch Hurwitz, I've heard him sort of talk about the fact that he was able to keep that in mind and that viewers would be able to watch a number of episodes, that they could watch them in any order. They could rewatch them in any order. At any time, they could move back and forth among the episodes. And I think, you know, this is the first writer who's really had that opportunity. And so I think in time, we'll see more creatives thinking about the opportunities that different kinds of distribution allow. I think one place that we've seen a sense of this already is the different kind of things you hear creators for cable say about what it's like to write and produce for cable as opposed to broadcast.
So, for example, Mad Men.
Sure. So Mad Men, the idea of the 13-episode season, the fact that you don't have to tell sort of 21 hours of narrative over a season, that's one of the things that cable has pioneered. The premium cable networks that don't have commercials, that you don't have to write to a commercial break every 10 minutes or so. It's also something that's quite freeing for writers. And when you're not – when you're writing episodes that are actually an hour instead of episodes that are 45 minutes, that also is a difference in the kind of story you can tell and how much you can fit in and what you can expect viewers to know and remember.
What we're talking about now, this idea of moving toward an online subscription format, what does that mean if you are sitting there in the offices of ABC, CBS, and NBC?
I think the big challenge is having any idea what the timeline for these transitions will be. You know, so right now we have, you know, early adopter behavior. It's not a mass audience. Netflix isn't about 20 million homes. It's certainly something that they're watching and they're concerned about. But the other thing is keeping in mind sort of the difference between what a broadcast network produces. In the course of a day, a broadcast network produces a morning newscast. The affiliates typically do the lunch news. They do their evening newscast. Then they have the prime time that we're familiar with, and they have the nighttime news. And so that's a lot of hours of original programming each and every day. And we're talking about Netflix, and they have created, in the case of Arrested Development, they created 15 half hours, right?
Period.
Of programming.
Not a day.
Right.
Yeah.
So in many ways, it is an entirely different phenomenon. And it's this question of when the audience is going to move. And even, you know, there are different kinds of programming that lend itself, like the shows that we've been talking about that have very specific audiences. One of the biggest show forms that continues to gather a mass audience on television is sports. And sports, you know, sports doesn't work as well in that model. Sports is something that people still watch live. They sit there through the commercials. And so that older economic model supports sports very, very well.
Look at the Super Bowl.
The Super Bowl, the experiment that CBS ran this season, it's not really an experiment anymore, but with March Madness and making it available, you can stream all of the games on all of your devices, and their streaming numbers were way up, and their audience for the on the regular TV set games was also up. So I think what the networks are seeing is that even though originally there was a fear of cannibalization, that these new devices and letting people watch in other places would take away from that linear audience, instead, if you make television more convenient, it actually just expands your audience.
Now, Arrested Development was released last like
Memorial
short,
Day Sunday.
Yes. So how have you had any sense or what's the sense of success?
Well, Netflix is guarding that data quite closely.
Oh.
as they do. And in truth, that's the other advantage that Netflix has in this. And Arrested Development was perhaps less risky for them because they have all sorts of data about who has watched those previous seasons. You know, so why did they pick Arrested Development out of all of the other things they could develop?
Yeah.
They saw the kind of fan base. They saw what people who watch this also watch these other kind of shows. So, the how many question isn't as much of an issue for a subscription service. What they're mainly concerned with is that people continue to subscribe. And certainly something like Arrested Development is going to drive new subscribers. So what they're watching is there a bump in their subscriptions this month? And does that bump go away in the next few months? And that's really probably far more important to them than, you know, how many people actually watch this particular show.
Amanda Lotz, University of Michigan Professor of Communication Studies. Always happy to talk TV. Thanks for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
You forget who you are. You find out everything.
That's the sound of Midnight Faces, a duo consisting of Phil Stansel, who's been playing around Grand Rapids since he was in grade school, and Matt Warren, who's a product of the Philadelphia music scene. He now lives in Washington, D.C. But the pair have been able to work around that distance between Grand Rapids and D.C. and come up with their debut full-length album and gearing up to play dates in the U.S. and possibly Japan. Phil Stansel and Matt Warren join us now from Grand Rapids. Phil, I want to have you start. Tell us, how would you describe your sound?
Well, I would say it's kind of like 80s synth pop. We take a lot from 80s musicians that we like, and then we blend in some newer aspects. And Matt grew up listening to a lot of 80s music. I actually listened to a lot of classic rock, so the vocals are kind of more like a classic rock style mixed with 80s backing music, as you could say.
In fact, I have to say, as I was listening, I heard echoes of you too in your guitar playing and in your vocals, which just made me very happy. Now, you've both been making music in different cities for quite a while. Matt, how did you cross paths?
Well, actually, our significant others are sisters, and so we've been hanging out for a few years now, and it wasn't until last November that we started actually like making music together. We both knew that each other, we were musicians, but it's just kind of one of those things where you're not sure how compatible you'll be with someone, so you don't really go there.
Yeah.
But we sat down with some of the songs that I was making, and Phil added some vocal parts, and it just kind of worked out really well. So we went with it.
What kind of music, Phil, were you doing playing around Grand Rapids on your own?
I played in two groups primarily, one of them being a group called Potato Moon, which is made up of my family. So it was me, my brother, my two sisters, my dad, and our mom actually acted as our manager. And we played folk, roots rock, rhythm and blues stuff. And then I was in another group with a group of buddies, and we played kind of rock and roll, classic rock covers, jam music, and that was kind of just a fun thing to do on the weekends. So,
tell us about the title track, Fornication.
Well, it's definitely a bit of a moody track. When Matt showed me the sounds and the backing music, I thought kind of go a moody, dark route. So that's where the lyrics came in. But we definitely wanted the opener track to be a powerful, big chorus one. So that's kind of where that came about.
All right, let's take a listen.
At the end of it all, I see your face. But if it's gotta be you, I take my chance. Far away from it all, there I go. And now I see the way.
What do you both feel in your hearts makes Midnight Faces unique?
I think the sound is very, it's 80s, but it's also modern in a way. And I think a lot of bands are doing that. A lot of bands will reference like Joy Division in their bios these days. But the difference, I think, is in a way it's Phil's voice. He's a very powerful singer and has a very legitimately good voice. At least that's my opinion.
How about writing? The fact that, in fact, as I checked by MapQuest, you're 655.76 miles apart. So how do you overcome that distance and write and create this album?
It's really a two-part process in a way. I come up with the instrumental version of the song just because with my history of instrumental music, I always kind of wrote pop-structured songs. So I'll basically come up with that, and then I'll send it to Phil, and then when we reconvene in Michigan, then we'll start adding some vocals, and that's kind of how the songs start coming together.
Now, I know, Phil, you've been playing. Did I hear that you've really been playing since grade school in the Grand Rapids area?
I have, yeah. I got my first guitar when I was 7. I started a classic rock cover band when I was about 8, and we played till I was 14. And then shortly after that, I played with my family. Like I told you,
yeah.
They called Potato Moon. And I played with them, and it's been awesome. I've played all around Grand Rapids, West Michigan, Northern Michigan. So
how have the folks who have known you in Michigan from your work with Potato Moon, or even earlier if they were seeing you as a kid, how have your fans responded to this partnership with Matt?
So far, so good. But it's kind of early on, and I'm kind of interested to see how they will take it, because I've definitely never done anything in this style of music. So I'm interested to see how they respond. My close friends really like it, so hopefully that will spread out for everyone else too.
Well, we all know close friends can be very painfully honest. So if they're saying good things,
that's true.
That might tell you something.
That is true.
Now, Matt Warren, I hear that you guys are thinking of moving to California later this summer. Why is that?
In one way, well, we made the record out there, so we just have a lot of good connections to the area, and I think it just gives us access to a lot more of the things we want. Like, we want to be touring actively and meeting new musicians to play on our records, and LA is a really good place to do that sort of thing. There's people who are always willing, and there's an abundance of good musicians out there to come play on your music and stuff like that.
All right, before we take a listen to the second track, who wants to talk to us about the song Give In, Give Out?
I really like that track. That might be my favorite one on the album so far. I think it has a really big, big, cool chorus, and it's really fun to play live. And then verse, just driving verse, I like that.
All right, this is Give In, Give Out from the new album From Midnight Faces. Phil Stansel and Matt Warren, Midnight Faces, and their website is midnightfaces.com. Their album, Fornication, will be released on June 18th. Guys, thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, we talk to a pair of Detroit boosters who are campaigning and campaigning hard to get ESPN to choose the Motor City as the site for the summer 2014 X Games. That comes up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio, and I'm Cynthia Canty. Wayne County Executive Robert Ficano has hit the pause button on a project to build a new Wayne County jail in downtown Detroit. The reason? The still unfinished 2,000-bed jail could cost up to $91 million over its $220 million budget. So the county is now considering cutting its considerable losses and leasing a former state prison on Detroit's east side. Crane's Detroit business writer Bill Shea got to thinking about this sorry episode in government spending, and the word boondoggle came to mind. His story in Crane's is headlined, Many Dollars, Little Cents, projects that seemed like a good idea at the time. And Bill Shea joins us now from Detroit. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Get us all on the same page, if you will, and give us your definition of boondoggle.
Well, there's a lot of different ways to look at that. You know, it could be a project with massive cost overruns, a completely unnecessary project, or, you know, a project rife with bad or crooked decision making, or sometimes it's just bad luck, and sometimes it's all of those things.
And tell us, as you look at the current headlines about the new Wayne County Jail, it fits into that category because?
Well, the cost overruns are what has everybody, you know, up in arms. You know, that's the classic definition, or one of the classic definitions of a boondoggle, where all of a sudden, out of the blue, we're looking at, you know, $91 million in unexpected cost overruns. So that has a lot of people concerned.
I dare say, especially considering finances in Wayne County are stressed as well. But as you show us in your piece in Crane's Detroit Business, there's a lot of history in Southeast Michigan when it comes to boondoggles. Can you take us back to that very, very sad episode in Flint of Six Flags Auto World?
Oh, yeah. Back in 1984, Six Flags Auto World opened as something that it couldn't quite decide if it was an amusement park or an automotive museum. And that was pretty much spelled the doom from the beginning. When you don't know what you are, people are not going to, you know, people are not sure what to think, and it was just a mess, and it was open full time for less than a year. It cost $80 million, you know, about 50 or so million of that in state, federal, local, you know, public funding. And today, Auto World sits underneath the University of Michigan Flint Library.
Now, let's talk about the Detroit People Mover, which was another ballyhooed thing that when it's coming, it's going to revitalize downtown and people can hop on the little train and get themselves around. It was 2.9 miles, right? And cost a lot of money.
Correct. Over $200 million. Now, in defense for the People Mover, the physical People Mover itself does what it is supposed to do. It operates on the loop downtown. But the problem is it was never designed or intended to just stand on its own. It was supposed to feed into a larger citywide mass transit system, which we never got, but they went ahead with the People Mover in hopes of it one day carrying lots and lots more people, you know, three or four times as many as what it's designed for. And, you know, maybe we'll get that with the, you know, the light rail system that's going in Detroit, but People Mover has been the poster child for Detroit transportation boondoggles for a long, long time.
I'm speaking with Crane's Detroit business writer Bill Shea, who did a really terrific overview of boondoggles we have known and not loved, Many Dollars and Little Cents, projects that seemed like good ideas at the time. An interesting story that you write about the Pinnacle Racecourse in Huron Township in Wayne County, really complicated with all kinds of people and all kinds of money involved in this thing.
Yeah, that proved to be really a Pandora's box, just oddball boondoggleness, if you will. I covered this one from the beginning. It was Jerry Campbell used to run the big bank out in Flint, Republic Bancorp, which he sold off. He and his wife also own one of the biggest stables in the state, and they're big into thoroughbred horses and racing. Decided they were going to take their money and build basically a small replica of Churchill Downs, you know, out by Metro Airport. They got, you know, a deal with the Wayne County Land Bank. They, you know, have X number of thousand jobs, and in return, they'd pay a buck and get this 300-some acres to build this horse racetrack. And so they did that. The county put in $26 million worth of infrastructure improvements for the roads, drainage, and stuff around the track and parking lots. And then the bottom fell out of the horse racing industry, and the bottom fell out of the state budget. Back in the a few years ago, the state cut the budget for the mandated personnel that tracks must have, state veterinarians and officials and things like that. So they couldn't race. They couldn't have live racing, which they desperately needed. And they don't have slot machines, which all tracks claim they need to survive. So they fell behind in their taxes and construction payment, all that sort of thing. And their Wayne County is, they put all this money in, the tracks failed, and, and then the cherry on top of this thing is, one of the co-developers is Jack Rasula, who has a, major corporate headhunting firm.
Yes.
And that firm was hired by the airport to find a new executive. Who did they pick? Turkia Mullen, Wayne County's chief development director, who swung the racetrack deal. So you have, at least the appearance of impropriety there, whether it's true or not, we'll never know. But, it just added further fuel to the fire, for, critics of this racetrack deal, that everybody's in bed with everybody, so to speak.
There was kind of an aroma to all of that, wasn't there?
Exactly.
Now, speaking of the state changing gears and changing course and hindering plans that were sailing along, I think you could apply that argument to what happened in Allen Park. With high hopes for Michigan's movie industry, and I still remember the press conference when the mayor of Allen Park, put on a Frank Sinatra hat and he was singing New York, New York, and feeling great, announcing Unity Studios, a big movie studio development. Give us the Reader's Digest version of what happened with Unity.
Yeah, this one, I think a lot of people saw this coming down the pike as a potential boondoggle, because Allen Park was really the only community in Michigan just to jump whole hog with selling bonds and things, investing in a movie studio. We Michigan had the extremely lucrative incentives that would rebate up to 42% of a production's in-state cost, and that's just unheard of anywhere in the business. So Hollywood, as soon as they caught wind of that, everybody and their brothers coming here,
right?
And everyone here is like, well, here's the gravy train. Let's build studios and start all these services. And for a while, it was running gangbusters. So Allen Park's brain trust decides that, we've got this Hollywood veteran guy who wants to build a studio and have, actor and staff training and all that. So they issue $31 million in bonds back in 2009 for this Unity Studios, for this guy, Jimmy Lifton, who's actually from Southfield.
Yes.
They're going to build this almost $150 million facility, and, very quickly the state realizes that it can't sustain this subsidy, and when Governor Snyder is elected, he dropped the boom on it pretty quickly, and all of a sudden, Hollywood's looking elsewhere. Other states are competing for these productions. Louisiana's always been a big one. New York, everybody, saw what Michigan was doing and wanted a piece of the pie. So, those were all scaled back, and boom, no studios happening. That all falls through, and they move out, they try a couple other things, but Allen Park's, they're saddled with $2 million in debt service payments annually. They can't pay it. And last year, voters reject a tax increase. So Snyder ends up appointing Joyce Parker as emergency manager of Allen Park. They got $59 million in debt and $24 million in unfunded employee pension liability. They just can't pay it. So it's a real tragic story for the taxpayers out there. People were real eager, but it fell apart.
Well, if I think about a lot of these developments, and I'm gonna kind of drill down here into the Unity Studios. If you are an elected official of a city like Allen Park, or we'll say Flint with Auto World, or Detroit with projects, where jobs and population are vanishing, you've got vacant land. I know there was a Visteon Corporation site sitting there idle in Allen Park. It's hard, isn't it, to find the balancing act between finding something that could jumpstart your town, bring in money, bring in jobs, bring people in, so being a visionary leader, and then not falling for something that's too good to be true. Because don't you agree that if the right things had lined up, if the stars had aligned properly, that Allen Park Studio Center could have been a terrific success?
Yeah, theoretically, it could have. But in that case, you know, there had been a lot of critics of those subsidies. And I think if you looked at Rick Snyder's track record in his statements about things, it wasn't real hard to read the tea leaves on that those could be in jeopardy. And you're right in the sense, you know, it is hard when you're rolling the dice on, you know, what projects do you want to subsidize in your city or community. But in this case, Allen Park, I mean, this was I don't want to call it a Hail Mary, but it seemed like a really, really steep investment for a small, it was an auto community for a long time, you know, so they were casting around looking for miracles and things like that.
Yeah.
But this seemed like a really, really risky investment in an industry that really had not quite established itself. You know, it was like a silver boom, that sort of thing, where everybody rushes in, all the panhandlers and you know, setting up shops and stores and, you know, what happens when the silver runs out?
Yeah,
well, it did in this case, and we see what happens.
I'm curious, as you put your story together for Cranes, what thoughts do you have on what should bomb investments like these teach not only government leaders but also the public in terms of what demands and expectations should they hold their leaders to?
Well, I think it's a constant we learn the same lessons over and over, and I don't think we necessarily as public officials or the public forget. It's just that these things are often unintended. Occasionally there's, you know, mob tie-ins or, you know, just people with their hands in both feet sometimes in the cookie jar. And that's just the nature of human greed happens. But I think the lesson is always transparency, you know, having these public projects done in the open, and under scrutiny from the public, from the media, from other politicians and lawmakers, the checks and balances. It's very important to have. It doesn't often happen. Even when we know that we have a huge history of these ridiculous boondoggles, things still happen. And, you know, you're never going to prevent them. I mean, sometimes things just go bad. In the case of the horse racing track, you know, the industry fell apart. You know, the state budget went bad. You know, the track itself is a very nice facility. 20 years ago, it might have taken off and become one of the biggest horse racing tracks in the world. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
And, you know, these things necessarily aren't bad projects. We do need a jail somewhere, apparently. We just don't need one that's $91 million over budget on what's a primo piece of downtown Detroit land.
Bill Shea's story on boondoggles is very much worth reading. It can be found at cranesdetroit.com. Thanks for taking time to talk with us today, Bill.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity.
We turn now to something that two impassioned Detroit boosters certainly hope is not a boondoggle. Kevin Kreese and Garrett Kohler have launched an all-out campaign to get ESPN to choose Detroit for the summer 2014 X Games. These are ESPN's extreme sports answer to the Olympics. Kevin and Garrett join me now, and I'm wondering, what was the genesis of the X Games, and what would it mean to Detroit and Michigan to be the site of the 2014 Games?
Yeah, the X Games was this creation of ESPN to fill a programming slot, actually, in late summer that they didn't have any content for. This is way back in 94, I think. And so they saw this rising movement of skateboarders in the country, and it really paralleled with the punk music movement and skateboarding. And they created just sort of an event to showcase skaters. And it showcased a lot more events, bungee jumping, things like that. And that property has grown over the years now to now we're in 2013. And this is a huge event where we think we're going to be bringing over 150,000 people for a three-day weekend festival. And they're leaving L.A., and that's what we're bidding on.
So L.A.'s had it.
Yep.
And so what the hope is that, what, this would be the permanent home?
Well, it's for a three-year contract, but they don't like to move this around. So we think that it's really more of a permanent position.
Now, I have to ask you, Garrett, what got you guys thinking about this, particularly since my understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, neither of you do extreme sports in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think we both have a profound appreciation for the underlying culture, right? So extreme sports, the action sports, is all about a certain lifestyle, and that lifestyle is taking action in a crazy way, taking risks, and, you know, succeeding in a big way and sometimes failing in a pretty epic way, but they always pick themselves up and do it again. So it's always resonated with us. And we thought it was a perfect fit for the city of Detroit when we heard that they were moving it. So
you heard they were moving it. And how did you connect together to say, all right, let's take action?
Well, you know, this is the case in Detroit now is all the young people there are really looking to do interesting things. And I had been living downtown for the past 4 years, and I had been looking for something I wanted to get involved in. And so when this opportunity really presented itself, we thought this makes too much sense to let it not happen. So we started talking to the different people and networking, and one thing led to another. And we partnered up with Quicken, and they believed what this could be a reality. And here we are.
So a phone call to ESPN and then putting other elements together?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty simple. We literally found this consulting firm that worked with ESPN on the internet. I emailed them. They connected us with the head of X Games. A week later, I got a coffee with him when he was in Detroit. I gave him a tour, and we just started the conversation from there.
So has this gone further than either of you thought it would when you...
I like to say wildly farther. Garrett likes to say...
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was living in Chicago when we started working on this and was working full-time for Groupon, had a great job. And I really saw the opportunity. I knew that this was something with a lot of underlying shared values between not only our friends but people in Detroit. And I knew it could mean something huge for the city and people who care about the city. So I think it has become as big as we thought it could in our wildest dream.
What we hoped. It's like, yes, what you dream about. It's like, sure, imagine coming across an idea and coming up with some wild ideas and dreams way back when, and then you're able to execute on all those, and now you find yourself in June in a pretty strong position with a bid submitted to ESPN, and this is, you know, like, wild.
So here you are. You're in the final round vying against Chicago. And now you're here. You love Chicago, and you're here,
yes,
now, Garrett.
Yes.
Austin, Texas, and Charlotte, North Carolina. So why do you think Detroit made it into the Final Four in ESPN's opinion?
I mean, what they said on their finalist press release, they actually explicitly called out our bid as being vociferous, was their word. We've created this movement that, I mean, we've been absolutely humbled by just the way that people have gathered around this thing. And, you know, I think we've exposed that properly to ESPN, and they've seen it. And they understand the value of that kind of collective support. I mean, there's a numerical, a financial value to that, but there's also this sort of intangible brand value, mm-hmm, when you have a huge community of people around a movement, an idea, and if you can leverage that and attach it to a brand that really fits, that's a powerful thing.
And it makes me kind of wonder, when you speak of the brand, is that Detroit brand, yeah, I mean, you think of the Chrysler M&M spot in, mm-hmm, the Super Bowl a couple years back that just set the world on its ear.
We think the brand alignment's absolutely perfect, yeah, for the X Games.
And we think it works both ways. We think that we better the X Games brand with our Detroit story, mm-hmm, but then we think that the X Games really helps bring the Detroit story to a whole new level.
So you're going to let us know when you hear the verdict.
Yeah,
you got it.
Of course.
Kevin Kreese and Garrett Kohler, who've launched this bid to win over ESPN and get the 2014 X Games to Detroit and keep it there. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks
today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Peg Watson and by Tony Brown. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow at 3:00.